Hello, everybody. Merry Christmas. Thank you for joining your pals Dave and Tim on this, another edition of True Crime Tuesday. And oh, we have the gifts to keep on giving a little bit later, Tim. More dumb crimes, stupid criminals.
Awesome.
You know what we should do is I should go back through the archives for the last year and try to just come up with some of the legitimately stupidest crimes that we read and may have missed and do an episode just on that. As kind of a 2018 Idiots in Review segment. Because there's a lot of crimes. People keep sending me stories after the fact, but I love all the stuff we've got. And remember, if you have crimes in your own area that are taking place and you feel that we should report on them, then please make sure you email to dave@darknessradio.com. Because I know Florida Man is not the only state with idiots.
Right.
I know there are many idiots around the world, Tim. Absolutely. You and I know many of them personally.
Yeah, I have a small gathering. I like to call them it's like the Justice League of Idiots.
Justice League of Idiots.
We have our own clubhouse. It's just really a big refrigerator box we all stay in, but yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. You know, hey, it is what it is,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. So email us if you have any dumb crime, stupid criminals in your area, or you can even email me if you have your own dumb crime, stupid criminals. Just let me know what's going on. We'd love to hear your story. Were you arrested for something ridiculously stupid? Then you can email us your personal story and we'll share those on an upcoming episode. But let's get started, Tim, with our main guest. Joining us now is John Paul Fay. He is the author of the book, The Shawcross Letters: My Journey into the Mind of Evil. And I don't want to give too much away in the biography because I want people to kind of watch as this story unfolds. So welcome to the show, John, and thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Let's start off with a little bit of your background, because this is a unique situation where it's not just the criminal in this case that's fascinating, but the author has got a pretty interesting take on this as well. You are you a... Do they call it murderabilia collector? Is that the right term?
I have been, but that's almost incidental, to be truthful with you. It's, more of a, I was trying to discover who and what I was like in that regard. Say being in touch with Arthur Shawcross or Dennis Nielsen briefly. I was just trying to figure myself out. I just happened to have sold murderabilia, so-called, back when you could do so on eBay.
Okay.
But it was more of a background thing for me. It wasn't my primary means of income, certainly, or primary interest.
What got you into that, drawn into that category of collecting and sales, though?
It's just because I grew up with that mindset. I grew up around it, and I have a definite unique firsthand thinking or mentality in regard to, say, being able to identify with, say, a Jeffrey Dahmer type specifically, or Dennis Nielsen, as I mentioned. But so it's something I kind of just inborn, I suppose. I took a different route. I mean, thankfully, first and foremost, a writer rather than having gone down Jeffrey Dahmer's road, so to speak. That's the whole purpose of my having gotten into this stuff to begin with, and just a journey of self-discovery, as it were.
And dealing in, I'm just curious about the murderabilia field. I mean, how rabid is the collector's market on things like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people are into buying the hair from various murderers and whatever, nail clippings, handprints, you know, all that type of thing. And there was this... that goes on, and people are pretty rabid about it, and as much as even they themselves might not admit. But yeah, no, it's a totally valid market still. There are specific murderabilia websites that still sell all that or auction it. You know.
Why do you think, I guess it's where do you draw the line in strange and absurdness, but all right, yeah. maybe a painting by John Gacy, I can understand that. Maybe a hand signed letter from him with, some details of who and why he did what he did and who he was, that I might be able to, but like hair clippings, toenail clippings, fingernail clippings, teeth.
Right.
What is that specific and that kind of, personal and weird? Why do you think people want to have that?
I mean, it was never my thing personally, but I think they want to feel a kinship of some kind and to be able to reach out and touch these people in any way that they can. And I mean, there are specific types of women who are into this stuff. I even knew a necrophiliac woman who works at a morgue, honestly. And, you know, she was into that stuff. And but hybristophilia, that's what it is. It's hybristophilia. There are women especially who are into this stuff, because it's basically it's another version of having power, you know, and women are attracted to power. So that's a big part of it. And they're looking for any way to, again, to grab onto that however they can. And yeah, so that's what I found. I discovered many years ago.
According to your bio, you kind of had a bit of a checkered past as well. Is that something that you feel comfortable talking a little bit about?
Yeah, oh, totally. I'm open about everything. That was the point. Yeah, writing that. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm, you know, again, I come from a very dark past, I suppose you could say. It's kind of a very much a Texas Chainsaw Massacre type of family unit, you know, so to speak.
Hold on a second. We need to delve into that a little bit deeper. I mean, that was a maniacal family of murderers and cannibals.
Yeah, well, you know, I never asked specifics about every family member, but it's like, for instance, my uncle Georgie, my great uncle Georgie, you know, he used to kill Germans during World War II and take their the gold out of their teeth and pawn that for booze, for instance. You know, it's that type of, you know, family mentality, and we seem to have all kind of shared that thinking in one way or another, you know. And in certain ways I'm considered worse than him, and you know, and but you know, I never went out and murdered anybody, but in terms of my addictive behavior and my having gone way over the edge, you know, apparently I'm even more extreme than Uncle Georgie. Which is hard to believe, because he has some a lot of strangeness in his background. But
it wasn't like he was just out randomly walking streets killing Germans or Nazis.
Not to my knowledge. I don't think so. No, he was actually in the service.
Right. But, so what he was doing was not so much in the maniacal serial killer mode as it was more what his government had sent him out to do. I just think that's an important point to mention.
Right.
Yeah. But you do what you have to do at that point to survive, which sounds cruel and inhuman, but stealing the gold, jewelry and things like that in order to use as the barter system was part and an important part of survival for a lot of our servicemen over there.
Yeah. The spoils of war. Yeah, exactly. That's true. That's very true. But I would say also, it's like I was thinking of House of a Thousand Corpses, with the head of the family there was Otis, was a guy named Otis, I forget who was played by now. But yeah, it's, I kind of find a kinship with him in a sense. In a sense, you know, again, thankfully I have not gone down that route. I've focused on writing, but I've come very close, you know.
When did that start for you? I mean, was there, you know, did when you started having, I don't know, is fantasy the right word?
When it became obvious, I was about 15. So, yeah, I was around 15, and I'm 42 now. It was funny. The timing was funny, because shortly after that started, like it was after my own thoughts started, that Jeffrey Dahmer came onto the scene. And, you know, it was somebody I could relate to. So.
So in your own machinations, was it the same kind of fantasy, the concept or idea of murder and eating people?
Yeah, the same concept. And it wasn't so much sexual for me. It was more about, I guess, the cannibalism, you know, for me. I don't know. It's kind of exotic. It's an exotic mindset as far as I'm concerned. I mean, obviously, it's certainly unusual at the very least. But that's just how I felt. That just occurred to me. And I wrote about this in the book, that it occurred to me one night. I woke up and it was like I had already tasted flesh in my past. You know, it was weird. And I had like a craving for it all of a sudden out of nowhere, seemingly. And ever since then, it's been with me, but I've been able to, curb it to a great extent, thankfully. Obviously,
what do you think?
years. Yeah.
Right. What do you think is the difference between you and an Ed Gein who couldn't quell that? You know, had the same fantasies, ideas, and desires, but actually acted out on it. What is the anchor point for you that kept you from tipping over that level into true darkness?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. I think part of it is I still had some people who care about me and have cared about me. And, you know, it's that, as few and far between as they are, but, it's that and prison for me. Prison goes a long way for me because I've already, you know, been to jail and hospitals and everything. And that's a major deterrent for me, personally. But, you know, aside from that, you know, it's hard to say because between the ages of 15 and 26 or 27, I was, very much on that road, you know, and I wrote about this that, you know, I went out in July of 2001, just before 9/11, you know, with the mindset to maybe collect a hooker's head that I'd seen this prostitute in the street a couple of weeks prior. And I had been drinking and whatnot, but it occurred to me that would be a rational thing to do at that time. So I went out, I had a bag with me and everything. And, you know, it's funny, I didn't end up running into the hooker. But I ran into this guy, gang member, who tried to hold me up at gunpoint. And thankfully, I had my own weapon. And so I overcame that because, yeah, I just don't believe in handing out. Yeah, go on.
Do you believe that then in your turn and kind of exhausting the adrenaline rush on this would-be criminal may have been what stopped you from carrying out that deed?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's what I've thought for all these years, actually. I think it did get that out of my system in a way different way than I could have expected. But yeah, it's funny you say that. Yeah, that's how I absolutely feel. So, it worked out for the best. And it was more because I realized over time that I'm more of a Dexter mindset or, you know, Charlie Bronson, Death Wish. I prefer that rather than hurt, you know,
so
anybody.
You saw yourself, right? I mean, obviously you first had that murderous intent towards an innocent, but you felt that after that moment, did that turn you more into the sense of being a vigilante feel?
Yeah, yes, yes. And there was still the, you know, a warped kind of mindset, but it was focused towards, you know, true criminals, you know. So, yes, absolutely.
So would you find yourself out stalking bad people at any point?
I have been out there, yeah. And people are amazed because I live in East Boston here, you know, that I do go out. I walk the streets all times of night, and this is considered a relatively dangerous part of the world. And I'm out there 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and people consider me scary because I do that. But, yeah, so I'm ready for it, and I'm at least half-heartedly hoping for it, you know. But nobody has approached me in that manner since 2001, and I've been walking the streets ever since, you know. So,
In that sense, then, John, if you were out there and somebody were to pull a weapon or try to attack, do you have any issue with the idea of, you know, taking a life at that moment?
No. I say if I had a pistol at that time in 2001, instead of what I like to work with chemical weapons. But if I had a pistol, I would have shot him in the face instead of what I did. You know, so I wouldn't have had a problem with it either. I would have been fine with that. Yes. I don't believe in just giving over what you have, because who's to say that, you know, they're going to let you go after that or whatever. You know, that's happened many times. People give over everything they have and they're still killed. So.
You know, when you say that you work, okay, when you say you work more in the field of chemical warfare, what exactly do you mean by that?
I like to blind the people, and I think they suffer more this way with the chemical warfare. Like there's what I consider like Batman weapons. It's not just mace. It's like pepper foam and pepper gel, where it actually encompasses their entire face. And the more they try to rub it out, the deeper it's ground into their eyes. And, it really messes people up. So I think that works better in a sense, because they deserve to be punished. You know, that's the way I see it. I think shooting them might be too easy, to be honest with you. You know, So that's what I mean. I understand.
If you're pushed to that point, though, John, where you feel it's time to take a life because somebody, you know, had the intent to take yours or possibly do you severe damage, do you think you would be able to stop at just stopping the offender, or do you think that you might actually take yourself to the end degree of that scenario? And if you did, would you are you afraid that at that point you might take the fantasy further and do the cannibalistic, you know, rituals?
Yeah, maybe under different circumstances if I had them in a controlled environment. Yeah, but as far as being out on the street, no, I would be satisfied with just stopping them and getting away from the situation. But again, in a contained, controlled environment, is, I don't know.
You've been prepared, but you've never actually had to employ the use of this chemical warfare to this date.
No, not to this date. But I've been prepared for a long time, you know. So it's just that's just the way my mind works. But I grew up with some very brutal father figures, of which, you know, Shawcross, I considered one of them. But
We'll talk about that as well. But, you know, tell me in the story here in your own narrative, which is equally as fascinating, as I said at the start of the show. So you had an uncle, I mean, and you said you had some other father figures that were not so good. I mean, are you witness? You may not have partaken in it, but are you witness to a murder?
Strangulations, but they haven't gone to what I witnessed as murder, but numerous strangulations, we'll say.
And these were physical attacks, not something that was driven by sexual pleasure. This was more along the lines of full-on attack.
Yeah, pure violence. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it remains with you, even though, you know, I've seen that stuff as a little child. You know, it sticks with you. It sticks with me anyway. I'm sure it colors every other aspect of my life.
So when you said that you were trying to figure out your place, and that's what drew you to kind of the murderabilia and the education about these different serial killers, would you feel, I mean, you said in the, you know, in the entertainment field, you felt connected to people from the, you know, House of 1,000 Corpses and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But when you were reading about and communicating with some of these serial killers, did you feel a certain kinship and understanding and maybe even an empathy for what they did and why they did what they did?
Well, again, I especially identify with Dahmer as far as Shawcross. I didn't exactly identify with him. I understood and, you know, but I couldn't see eye to eye on the way he did things for the most part, except for the cannibalistic mentality that he had, of course. But, he was a little more vicious than I prefer for me, but he's just the one I happen to connect with for whatever reason.
Now, had you written to many murderers, or was it just a select few?
No, it was a very, very select few. It was very select. And ultimately, it's, again, it's Shawcross who ended up writing to me because I was selling some of his artwork, but I wrote to Dennis Nielsen. I got one letter back from him because he was talking me out of suicide. Believe it or not, still have that letter. I had written to him, kind of reaching out to anybody. So desperate because I can't identify with many people, obviously. And yeah, he ended up actually writing me a very nice letter back and, you know, trying to talk me down from, at the time I was rather suicidal. And so he might have been responsible for that moment, talking me out of killing myself, believe it or not. Dennis Nielsen, you know the British Jeffrey Dahmer,
right? So, in that case, I mean, if you don't mind explaining, you were at that point, that dark void that many people stand at. What brought you to the concept of wanting to end your life? Was it because of the feelings that you had and realizing, you know, that was pretty much flying in the face of logic or society's acceptance?
Just overall desperate depression, you know. I've been praying for my own death since I was 14, 15 too, you know, so, but I don't know if that's directly related to, you know, those fantasies. In a way, those fantasies were comforting for me and exciting. But I think it's just a general depression that I felt throughout these years, which, you know, I'm, you know, in all kinds of treatment now. I actually see my new psychologist tomorrow, which is a good thing. It's good. I need somebody to talk to. And you just got to be careful who you talk to, because they could get you, they could have you locked up, or you alienate people. So I know it's a very, very delicate balance to maintain.
In that delicate balance, I mean, that's got to be tough, especially in a society like we have today, where you see violence and hatred portrayed on a daily basis in the news and on social media. And
right, right.
Is it a struggle every day for you to maintain that slice of humanity that would keep you from taking a life? And what brings you to the points where you almost are unable to bring yourself back? Is it an internal drive, an OCD? Is it is it just being fed up with a situation or society? Can you give us a little insight on that?
Yeah, sure. It's definitely a daily struggle. It's mostly a daily struggle to, you know, keep myself from harming myself. But it's become more, much more geared towards self-harm. But I withdraw from society in general, you know, because I think, all right, here's something interesting. Like, just when you think it's gone, or when I think it's gone, right, these type of thoughts, as soon as I'm around somebody who even vaguely gets under my skin, it's right there. It just pops right back up. And they could see it in me before I could even see it, you know, and as they're fearful, and men and women. But I have a special hatred for males, I guess, in general, as far as that stuff is concerned. But yeah, it really is always right under the surface. And it surprises me, too, because I think I'm getting better, you know, but that's just because I haven't been around people. And the moment I get around them again, they, you know, they irritate me to the slightest bit, you know, then it's right there, and I'm ready to do very, very terrible things to that person.
John, how, yeah. You know, I mean, that on a daily basis, I must get, you know, get that kind of anger myself, as most of us do, you know.
Yeah.
But it sounds like your grip on it is a lot looser. I mean, what do you credit the ability to hold back on? And I only ask this, not that I'm trying to push, but just trying to get an understanding.
No,
because doing a show on true crime for 8 years and discussing this, we're getting a unique perspective of not only the story we're going to talk about with Shawcross, but the story, you know, your story, which gives us an insight that, you know, we've never been able to share on the program before. But,
right,
you know,
right.
If it's that close to the surface all the time, you really have never acted out on that?
It's, I mean, aside from shackling a couple of people to my old apartment down where I used to live, you know, and I've done that. I've shackled people and drugged them and stuff. And I wrote about that. I'm open about all of that. I have no problem talking about it. But as far as not having crossed the line into actual murder, I think a big part of that, again, is prison, that aspect. But beyond that, of a spiritual mindset as well. And so there's probably some karmic payment eventually for doing that. And then, and just slightly beyond that, I've developed a little more empathy over time. And so I've developed at least from a like a Vulcan would see it, because I don't necessarily feel this. But basically, you don't do to other people what you don't want done to you. I guess that makes sense. So that's part of it. But again, I really see that more in an academic sense than, you know, actually feeling that full-heartedly.
So have you confronted your own thoughts then? When you're putting yourself out there on a nightly basis in a dangerous area, do you really think what you're trying to do is rid the area of scourge and villainy? Or are you kind of inviting suicide by somebody else doing it for you?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. It kind of goes both ways. In other words, I don't mind if I'm killed. It's all right. You know, so I'm at peace with that. It's kind of a samurai mindset, where you kind of go into war expecting to die. I wouldn't mind it. It's, you know, so I guess that makes me a little more dangerous, obviously. Yes, as far as what you just said about kind of ridding the streets of any squirming poisonous worms. I see a lot of these creatures as poisonous worms. You know, I wish I could do that more frequently, truthfully, and you know, in my own right. I don't know why the police should be the only ones who have that that luxury. It just doesn't make any sense to me. You know, they have the monopoly on taking out scumbags.
Now, when you open up about this, you open up about your story in the book as well, correct?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yes.
And you talk about that. I mean, you've shackled people. Is that why you ended up doing time? Was because of those moments?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was, well, it's like, and again, this is in the book, that, you know, I had, this was a self-defense case, but I did stab my my best friend. He stabbed me first, by the way, a couple of years prior. But I was still friends with him. You know, I still remain friends with him. It goes to show my mentality, how desperate I am for friendships, I guess. But, yeah, a couple of years later, I got around to stabbing him back. But it really was a self-defense situation. And I did it unconsciously. I wasn't even aware of, I didn't mean to do it as far as in a conscious level, you know, but I did it nonetheless. And so, you know, thankfully, though, I had a good public defender and he never showed up to court. And so the case was dismissed, thankfully. But yeah, that was one scenario. And it's generally, anytime I've been away, it's been related to violence, but it's all stemmed from my drinking, either way, slice of dice, so to speak. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if you know about Bridgewater over here, Bridgewater Prison. I was there. I was there for a month, about a couple of years ago. That was due to a probation violation and violence, or threatening violence. They put me in the hole. They call it the cell over there. Like the first night I was there, because they didn't realize I had threatened to, you know, cut certain people's hands and heads off, and they weren't sure if I was that much of if I was an actual threat to anybody there or whatever. So, you know, the first night they put me in the cell, which actually was the best night's sleep I had gotten for a year at that point. It really was. It's a peace, you know, because I'd been living with family for a year at that time, up to that point. And yeah, so that was actually a blessing, being put in solitary overnight. And even being put in Bridgewater, period. You know, I appreciated that. It gave me time to plan and think and get my head straightened. Get all the chemicals cleared out of my system. You know, so it worked out. It worked out for the best, because I'm actually doing much better now than I was before Bridgewater. Yeah, but yeah, Bridgewater is a prison slash mental institution. You know, criminally insane types, basically. But,
Do you ever worry? I mean, with your sense of justice and concept of the reality, do you ever worry that because of your own feelings you could step over? Do you think that I know you hate the concept of prison, but do you think that somebody with your kind of drive and desire should, you know, maybe not be free and out on the road and you know,
right.
That tipping point where it could happen at any time, especially you've got a high sense of justice,
right? Yeah,
that's got to be a strange conflict within you to not feel that.
It is. That's why I mostly just stay inside. Thankfully, I do finally have my own apartment. I'm basically a hermit at this point. I very rarely go out. But also, I've met a couple of people through the book, a couple of females that talk to me, and I'm able to, you know, kind of vent with them in a positive sense. So that goes a long way, too. Just again, just having people to talk to goes a long way for me. So, yeah, it's just keeping to myself and having a couple of women to talk to. That means the world to me, you know. And if that makes sense. But yeah, I'm constantly concerned, though. Yeah, anytime I go out, I'm concerned. Yeah.
What in kind of trying to choose who you wanted to communicate with, what was your initial plan for the murderers that you wanted to reach out to? Was it to get some insight into who they are and why they did what they did? Was it, as you mentioned earlier, desperate for friendship? Were you just trying to make some kind of human contact and figured because of who you are, it might be better to be friends with people like that?
Yeah, that's it. That's it right there. You know, it's just because, again, it's very hard for me to relate, obviously, to many people, clearly. You know, and so it's just, I don't know, it's like a last-ditch effort to humanize, you know, to try to humanize. And those people accepted me, you know, especially, again, Shawcross, but even Dennis Nielsen, who doesn't write to anybody, but he actually answered me. So, you know, the late Dennis Nielsen, no. But, yeah, so, yeah, it's just, it's more or less, yeah, desperation for just any human contact, yeah.
What was the advice from a murderer, a heinous killer, to you to save your life, to keep you alive? What was the advice he would give somebody like you for that?
Well, I have the letter here. I could read it, but basically the gist of it is that, you know, you still have things to live for. You don't have to off yourself because on a whim, you're going to think about it before you do anything drastic, you know, because he knew I was a writer too. He says, you know, you have a lot to say, so you know, stick around because life is short as it is, basically, as he would well know. So that's basically, the gist of it. Life is short enough as it is, you know.
Well, we're here to discuss the Shawcross letters then. Let's start in your first communication with Shawcross. What do you write to somebody like that to get their attention? I'm sure that they get many letters from people around the world, but what is it that you brought to him that made him decide you were worthy of responding to, do you think?
Yeah, as far as Shawcross, again, he was the one, ultimately, who initiated contact, because I had been selling, speaking of murderabilia, I was selling some of his artwork on there that I ended up with through, when I was selling other stuff on eBay through a trade. You know, I had traded some videotapes for some Shawcross art. And so he found out about that and basically, you know, got my information ultimately. And he started writing to me back in 2000, summer of 2000. And, you know, we just, at first I wasn't sure how to take it, like if he was angry with me or what the situation was. So I wrote him a very civil letter back and I said, well, maybe we could, you know, go 50-50 on future art. And he agreed with that arrangement. And, then he learned more about me as far as my, mindset. And we just, struck up, almost a brotherhood. I call it a brotherhood of ghouls, you know, and, that's we just took a liking to each other because, you know, we have a very a similar way of thinking in a lot of ways, you know.
Would you open and confess to him regarding your thoughts and fantasies?
Yeah, I was totally open with him about all of that.
How would he respond about that? Would he try to talk you out of it? Did you ever feel like he might be goading you into stepping out and executing?
Yeah, not overtly, but he would tell me, you know, be good or be good at it. You know, that's what he was always telling me. So he knew if I were going to do those things, there's nothing he could really say that would stop me. But and he wouldn't, he wouldn't openly try to goad me into any of that. But, you know, he didn't discourage me either. See, yeah. So, we talked about what I'm into, like shrunken heads, and he talked about severing heads and this type of deal. And yeah, it's just, I don't know. We hit it off after the initial couple of letters we exchanged. And we talked for several years.
How quickly did he begin to open up to you about specifics of his life and thoughts?
Let's see. That's a good. It was a matter of a couple of months, you know. Once he knew who I was, it was really a matter of a couple of months, because as open as I was with him, and he sent me the list of his victims, and they were, you know, they have him convicted of 12 murders or so, 13 murders, but and the FBI suspected him of 19 murders, and but he says there were even more than that. So he was never exactly specific with the other murders. But yeah, he told me there were certainly more than 19 in the United States.
Did he give you the list of all 19 that are known?
He gave me a pretty lengthy list, but I think it was mostly, as far as I know, the victims he's convicted for. But there are a few names on there I didn't recognize, if I remember correctly. But I'm pretty sure.
Is that something you ever decided to take to the law to let them see and evaluate the letter and evaluate the list so they know what was different than what they were aware of?
Yeah, I thought about that. And that was suggested by family members, but I never really did. I mean, I tried to stay away from law enforcement as much as possible. They were just at my home two weeks ago, because certain family members thought I was really going off the deep end and I was going to commit suicide. But that was not easy to talk my way out of, but I managed it, thankfully.
Let me ask you this.
Now. Yeah.
If I could ask.
Ask anything, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure, too, on this. All right, so you have a very high sense of morality when it comes to justice.
Right, yes.
And wanting people to be safe and saved, and
right.
Especially the innocents.
Yes.
You had not gone out and necessarily pushed for much more information from Shawcross. You were just kind of a receptacle of the information he was willing to share with you.
Yeah, I didn't push anything.
Right. And he died what on, was it, what year was that? 2008, that's what it was, right?
When he died in 2008.
Right.
Yeah.
And had you stayed friends with him throughout that entire time?
Almost up to that. We had a kind of falling out and he wasn't mad at me or anything, but, I was working on his book with him, his memoirs. And then, we ran into some trouble with a publisher and he basically, took it out on me, even though, I said, just give it a little more time. We'll get something published, as I finally did. But, he just, lost patience with that. Again, it wasn't even being mad at me. He just lost patience in general. We stopped talking, around 2006 or so. Yeah.
And and the reason I'm kind of asking this just to kind of get a feel and a vibe, as you said, you've got a list that he offered to you of names and,
right.
Here you've got, and with your passion for wanting justice, there are 12 that he, was convicted of, and you have lists that goes a little deeper.
Yeah. I included that all in the book. So anybody who wants to see it can see it. If they recognize anything, that's it.
So in the book, you list all of the names that he gave
you?
Yeah,
any names he gave me, I put in the book. So if there's a couple extra that aren't recognized by law enforcement officially, then they'll see it. I mean, it's out there. Anybody to see it. I did my best in that regard.
Sure.
It's kind of a pat,
Do you have, I'm just curious with the list, because I do have the list of 12, do you have the list of names that he gave to you? I'd just like to see of those, if anything else pops up that we're unfamiliar with.
Yeah, it's around here somewhere, but I would have to dig it out. It's in the book there somewhere. I would have to get the book here. Yeah.
Would he, when he gave you these names, would he give you the specifics of how he killed them or when he killed them?
Yeah, yes. With certain ones, he definitely did mention either beheadings, strangulations, and, of course, the cannibalism, naturally.
And did he keep a log, like he remembered every name of every victim that he murdered? Was that because he knew them or was tied into them? What was his...
Some of them he was tied into, some of them, but not all of them. There were certain people who were close to him that, relatively close to who he murdered. Yeah. It's just a lot of, he went off on 9/11 here and everything. Yeah, there's rants on 9/11, and, things like that. So I don't know where it is off the top of my head, but
when he would explain this to you, I mean, you were the keeper of the flame for him, this knowledge and information. And he was opening up to you, unlike anybody else that he was opening up to. Why do you feel that there was such a kinship? Why do you feel that he thought, this guy's all right. I can trust John Fay.
I have that way about me. I mean, he saw that I was being open and honest with him. I mean, I think he could pick up on that and I wasn't holding anything back. And so we just connected at that point. It was a true again, brotherly connection. And
all right, we had taken a temporary pause here to allow our guest to find the list that he was able to post and share regarding the names of Arthur Shawcross's victims. And I do have a cross-reference list, but can you tell me what names on the list he was able to give you?
Yeah, he has their hair color and everything here, but I'll just mention the names. Of course, Darlene Trippi, June Stocks, June Cicero. He found that fascinating, by the way, that he had two Junes. But Dorothy Blackburn, Patty Ives, Dorothy Keller, Maria Welch, Anna Steffen, Elizabeth Gibson, Felicia Stevens, Frances Brown, let's see, Barbara Dobson, Karen Hill.
Hold on 1 second. Barbara
Dobson.
And now, does he give you information of when those murders took place as well?
Let's see. There's no indication right here.
Or where it took place? Does he give any of that information?
There are no specifics in that regard. He just has their hair color and has this little teaser here. He says, shall I go on? Got you thinking, do I not? You know, and basically it says, who I effed and who I killed, you know, so.
So this list is not all necessarily people he murdered, some that he.
I'm wondering that. That's the curious thing. I mean, I've been wondering that for years, to be truthful with you.
Sure. Now, you said Barbara Dobson. What was the name after Barbara Dobson that he gave you on the list?
Oh, Karen Hill. You know about that one. That was one of his earlier ones. That was little girl there. Kathy Murdoch. Yeah. Go on. Yeah.
No, I'm just, what'd you say, Kathy Murdoch?
Yeah. Mildred Winters, Colleen Lund.
Hold on 1 second. I'm just jotting these down as well so I can look up information. I'm fascinated to see if this was ever done. So Mildred, what was Mildred's last name?
Winters.
Winters, okay.
Yeah.
And then?
Colleen Lund, L-U-N-D.
All right.
All right. Nancy Salisbury. Martha Carr with 2 R, C-A-R-R.
Okay.
Sarah Chatterson.
S-A-R-A. Is there an H in Sarah or is it just S-A-R-A?
Yeah, I was going to say there's an H. Yeah, there's an H. S-A-R-A-H.
And what was her last name?
Chatterson. C-H-A-T-T-E-R-S-O-N.
Okay.
Okay. Linda Neary, and that's N-E-A-R-Y.
N-E-A-R-Y, okay.
Yeah, Penelope Shabino, S-H-A-B-I-N-O. Yeah. Irene Kane, and that's Kane, K-A-N-E.
Okay.
All right. And then this is an interesting name, Cilia Rossiter, and that's Cilia, S-I-L-L-I-A. And Rossiter, R-O-S-I-T-E-R.
Okay.
All right. And there's a Susan Rigastana, and I'll spell that last name there, but it's R-I-G-E-S-T-A-G-N-A.
Okay.
Rose Stilson, and that's S-T-I-L. S-O-N, first name Rose, and Darlene Wally, it's W-A-L-L-E-Y, and let's see, there's Laura Anderson, and A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, and Jack Blake, that's an infamous one, I actually talked to his sister and Dr. Phil.
Now, why is that name not listed on his series of murders, or is that because there were multiple series of murders?
There were a couple of separate series, I guess. He killed a couple of kids, actually, when he was younger, back in the 70s. And then when they let him out of prison, and he started to kill again, but he was focused on, prostitutes, women, and just people he was friends with for a bit, who worked for him or whatever, homeless women type of thing.
But man, to have, and I'm sorry, Jack Blake was the name. Did you have any other names after Jack Blake?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's Michael Miller. Yeah, Michael Miller. There's another. There's David Edson on here, which surprises me. There are more male names than I remember. But yeah, David Edson, E-D-S-O-N. Kim Soo Young, that's K-I-M S-U-Y-O-N-G. There's Darlene Sawyer, Beverly Horning.
Beverly Horning, boy, this list is.
It's
Beverly,
it's,
and what was her last name? Beverly what?
Horning, H-O-N, like H-O-R-N-I-N-G.
Okay.
And Sharon Van De Walker, and that's V-A-N-D-E-W-A-L.
First name Sharon, S-H-A-R-O-N?
Oh, yeah, it's S-H-E-R-O-N.
S-H-E-R-O-N, okay.
Yeah, and Van De Walker, that's V-A-N-D-E-W-A-L-K-E-R. There's also after that, there's just a couple left here. Laura White, W-H-I-T, W-H-I-T-E, and first name Laura, L-A-U-R-A. Kara Duda, and last name, that's Kara, K-A-R-A, and then last name Duda, D-U-D-A. And finally, it's Kimberly Sanderson. And then, you know, after that, just might be worth mentioning, says, better stop running off of the lip, might say something I shouldn't. Later, Art. Yeah, so that's
a chilling amount of names. I mean, just in the ones I wrote down, because looking at the list here, there's the 12. After the 12, I have what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27. So somewhere around 27 to 30 names are on this list.
I didn't even realize there were that many. Yeah.
Right. Now, and I'm just looking over kind of the information online about it. It says in March 1988, Shawcross began murdering again, primarily sex workers in the area. So some of these names are people that he had been, I guess, let's start at the beginning. When did he begin his killing spree? And that was what, May 7th of 1972?
Right,
When he killed and raped, 10-year-old Jack Owen Blake, right?
Yeah. Jack Blake and Karen Hill.
All right.
Yeah,
So those two, Jack Blake, that was part of it, but not part of the block of 11 that were those women mostly the prostitutes that the Dorothy Blackburn, Anna Stefan, Dorothy Keeler, Patricia Ives, June Scott, Marie Welsh, Frances Brown, Kimberly Logan, Elizabeth Gibson, Darlene Trippi, June Cicero, and Felicia Stevens. Were those all prostitutes? Do you know?
Yeah, they were mostly prostitutes, but there were at least one or two homeless women too who worked for him or who he was friends with who he ended up murdering as well. But mostly sex workers, yeah.
Would he be open with you about the fact of what made him choose those people? Was it just, was he a killer of, spontaneity? Was it just, the time and place is right now? Would there be some that he would get together with that he didn't kill?
No, yeah, there were a lot he got together with that he didn't kill, yeah. It just, he was in a bad mood one night or whatever, and they would say something that would make him angry or do something that would make him angry, and he would end up just murdering them, I mean, bottom line, yeah.
So just to give people a quick overview again, on May 7th, 1972, he sexually abused and killed 10-year-old Jack Owen Blake, his first known victim, after luring the boy into some woods in Waterton. 4 months later, on September 2nd, he sexually abused and killed 8-year-old Karen Ann Hill, who had been visiting Watertown with her mother for the Labor Day weekend. Arrested in October, he confessed to both killings, and under the terms of a plea bargain, he agreed to reveal the location of Blake's body. In return, he was permitted to plead guilty to a lesser charge of manslaughter in the Hill case. All other charges were dropped, and he received a 25-year sentence at Greenhaven Correctional Facility. But after 12 years, an experienced prison staff and social workers concluded that Shawcross was no longer dangerous, disregarding the warnings of psychiatrists who had addressed Shawcross as a schizoid psychopath. He was released on parole, folks, released on parole 12 years after murdering two children on April 1987. And he had difficulty settling down in communities, it says here, as the neighbors would protest his presence and employers would fire him once they found out who he was. He moved into Binghamtown, New York, and relocated again to Delhi, New York, with his girlfriend, Rose Marie Whaley. Now, wasn't there a, well, there was a Darlene Whaley. Is she related to Rose Marie Whaley?
Was there a Darlene Whaley? Yeah, she, that's a good question.
Because it says here his girlfriend was Rose Marie Whaley.
Right.
And then on your list, there's a Darlene Whaley. Spelled the same way.
I wonder. I am honestly not certain on that one.
When Delhi residents became aware of Shawcross' presence and the couple moved to a nearby Fleischmann's, New York, only to be met with hostility there as well. Finally, in late June of 1987, Shawcross's parole officer moved him and Whaley into a transient hotel in Rochester, New York, but failed to notify Rochester authorities of this action. And in mid-October, Shawcross and Whaley found more permanent lodgings at 241 Alexander Street in Rochester. And then that's where things go off the rails again, because in 1988, Shawcross began murdering again, primarily sex workers in the area. Apart from June Stott, they said, who was a local and was the first one of his victims to be mutilated after her death. And before his capture, less than 2 years later, he was convicted of 11 murders with a 12th not officially charged to him. And then they give that list of victims. Why do you think they never pushed for further, you know, do you think it was just, well, we got our man, he's never going to get out anyway on what we've got him on, there's no sense in pursuing the rest of these cases?
Yeah, that's how I feel about it. Yeah, I mean, he was already doing a quarter of a century. He was doing 250 years already, so what difference would it have made, really, at the end of the day, to go through all those resources to continue to prosecute him? Already going to spend the rest of his life in there.
And you listed these in your book. You gave this list that you just shared with us. So law enforcement has the capability to see that list and reexamine that list. And if they came to you and said, we'd like you to turn over that letter to us where it's specifically handwritten and the information was given to you, is that something that you would be willing to do in the honor of justice and helping these other families?
If they asked me, I would. And, again, I'm very open about all this. It's right in the book. I didn't hold anything back, you know. So, yeah.
It's fascinating. And how long the book has been out since, what, January or February of this year?
February, yes. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
It's interesting that there hasn't been more attention drawn to that, especially with people looking for answers for what happened to their family members. Unfortunately, Shawcross is dead now. But if it gave some peace and understanding to people to know who it was that murdered him. Now, did you ever get the feel that he was just being braggadocious, that maybe he had nothing to do with some of these murders, but was trying to impress you with how amazing and brutal he was?
Yeah, that's a very valid question. And I don't know. I get the sense he was being truthful with me, but it's hard to say, you know, it's really hard to say. I obviously it wasn't in his head. So who knows? But, I don't know. I just get the sense that he wasn't holding much back from me. That's how I feel. Anyway, that's my intuition.
I understand that you felt a certain kinship to him, but when he would rattle off a list of 30 people that he murdered, was there ever a point where, you know, your sense of justice, you thought, you know, I can't keep talking to this guy. This guy's further gone than I could have ever conceived.
Right. Yeah. I didn't, Well, first of all, again, he's one of the very few people I had in my life to talk to, period. You tend to overlook even the most extreme things. But also, I didn't want to appear overly judgmental either, if that makes any sense. So I kind of let certain things go. I overlooked certain things, what he said, even like, you know, murdering the children. Obviously, that's not my my thing. So I just never talked. We never really talked about that. And he didn't want to talk about it either, just in general, in interviews. But yeah, I mean, that was upsetting for me, just the fact that he had murdered two children. You know, that's that goes against everything I'm about. So.
Right.
Just, you know, just
What were some of the big reveals that he would tell you? I mean, were there points that ever put you on your heels and made you hold off in contacting him for a while? And if you didn't, would he reach out to you again, wondering why you'd stopped contacting him?
Oh, well, somehow I missed a couple of his letters. They didn't get to me for whatever reason. And so he would continue to write pursuing me and said, what happened? I haven't heard from you in a few weeks, you know? And I had just happened to miss a letter or two here and there. But, so he would definitely pursue me, but I never intentionally stopped writing to him. I kept it going for as long as possible.
Does it make you wonder if some of those letters ended up in the hands of law enforcement?
I know, right? That's a good question too. Yeah, I wonder. I'm curious about that now. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe. Certainly, that's a possibility. Absolutely. Huh. Yeah.
All right. So in contacting him, keeping in touch, you were friends for how long total?
Let me think. 6 years.
6 years.
About 6 years. Yeah.
And yes. In that time, this kind of camaraderie and brotherhood that developed between the two of you, were you open to your friends and relatives about this? Did they know that you were in contact with murderers and killers? And if so, what was their take on it?
Yeah, they're aware of it. They didn't know the depths to which it went, you know. But they were at least vaguely aware of it. Yeah. But yeah, I never got into specifics about what he was writing to me and what I was writing to him. But they knew I was into all kinds of, you know, true crime stuff throughout my life and all kinds of weirdness and paranormal, whatever. So it's just they knew that was who I was, basically. And so they didn't really question it too much. Yeah. If at all, they just let it be. So,
gotcha.
And, yeah.
Do you, you wrote this book. What was the idea behind it? What did you want to share with the world? What did you think that they should know about this story?
Well, a big part of it was, meant to be ultimately a positive thing where I actually made it out to the other side for the most part. Of both this type of murderous thinking and addiction and whatnot, that's the ultimate thing that I made to the other side of that. And Shawcross was an ever present voice in the background of my life throughout the most hardcore of those years, basically. So that's the gist of it. I could expound further if you need to, but.
And did you feel that you were doing your friend a service by sharing his story at the end of his life and by putting this book out there?
Yeah, I didn't feel it was overly exploiting him too much, because I'm basically exploiting myself for the most part. My own struggles, whatnot. I felt it was valid. I mean, just at that point, I don't think it was people knew what he was, they knew who he was, and so I don't think there's anything in there that's super surprising as far as his character is perceived, you know. But we wanted to put a book out anyway. The book he was putting out was his own memoirs about everything related to his life anyhow. So I ended up doing that just a little later. That's just how it worked out. But yeah, he wanted the story out there anyway. So that's the way I perceive it. Anyhow.
Sure. Sure. Was it a moment of sadness for you when he did pass because your friendship had kind of stalled out and hit a wall?
Yeah. I regretted that we didn't have to have a final goodbye, I suppose. you know, I did feel bad about that, that it kind of ended so abruptly. Yeah. Yeah, I did. I was slightly sad about that. Still considered it losing a friend, regardless.
Regardless of the situation, right.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, yeah, I did have some regrets there. Absolutely.
All right. The as we're wrapping up here with this story in Shawcross, again, the book is out and available. We have a link to it. The Shawcross Letters, My Journey into the Mind of Evil. You delve deep into his personality and communication with this guy. You feel this kinship with him because there's this this internal battle that you're facing, trying to come to terms with who you are. Is the killer inside stronger than the man who believes in justice? Are you still right. fearful that at some point you will cross that line?
At this point, not so much. I feel a lot more at ease than I used to be. I mean, again, I'm mostly directly self-destructive, but even that is dissipating. You know, I do have, as I say, people to talk to, and, you know, I'm under doctor's care and everything. I'm on medications, and so I feel pretty stable now for the time being, but I've learned not to be overconfident with that type of thing, as I was saying earlier. So I just have to watch my step and not get lackadaisical with it. Just stay on top of myself, you know. But yeah, there's always a danger. There's always a danger. No question about that.
And we've got to,
as long as I'm aware of it.
You've got one of the letters posted. I'll just read one of the random letters that's on the page, if you don't mind. And this was dated July 6th of 2000. Mr. Fay, what was the drawing of mine that you sold? What did you sell the item for? I can use the money order only if it does not put you out. May I ask who bought said item? Can you send addresses of people who are collectors? Did you ever do that? Would you supply him with the names and addresses of the people that collected his items?
Let me think. I don't believe I ever did, to be honest with you. I just, again, I came to an agreement with him. I said, if you send me some more of your artwork, I'll just put it up on eBay at the time when you could do that, and we'll just split the proceeds. So I just took that direction with him. Yeah, because I don't recall sending him anybody's addresses. But
all right.
He sent,
it says,
you know.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, he sent me the addresses of a couple of women that he wanted me to go after, by the way, but, you know, I never did, of course, but he was pissed
off. Did he explain why he wanted you to go after them?
He thought they had screwed him over in one way or another, betrayed him in some way. They were, you know, selling his letters or whatever without, you know, they would come to him as if they're friends, and then they would turn their backs on him and go and sell his letters, you know, without asking him first or telling him. So he just considered these women had betrayed him.
And he was basically trying to put a hit on them by uncaging you.
Yeah, basically.
Did you ever follow basically. Up? Because you had to know you're not the only person he's writing to. Did you ever follow up with those names to see if the people he gave you ever ended up with an untimely demise or a mysterious death?
Right. I think he had I never looked that up. I still have their photographs and names and everything. But I never really followed up on that. That's interesting, though. Yeah.
Well, if you're up to it, yeah. I mean, even if you don't have the time, I know you've got a lot going on, and I certainly don't want to keep picking a scab for you. But if you are willing to share the names and photographs of those people, I'd even be happy to do the research to look and see if there was anything that came up that, you know, might preclude, you know, what happened to them. It's just fascinating to me if that aspect of their story ended mysteriously or in a death. Because it'd make you wonder who else he was in contact with that would go out and do his bidding.
That's true. Yeah. I wonder, I almost remember the name. I almost remember, I'd have to dig that out again. I don't know if I included that in the book, but, I almost remember the name.
Well, do me a favor. You have my contact information. Message me through the social media page again and let me know the names of the people that he wanted you out for. And if you have a way to scan those pictures, it would be interesting because I'm sure we'll run into some of the similar names that may have died. But if he gave you their information, it'd be interesting to know. The rest of the letter reads, where might you be moving to now that you have parted with one item of mine? Here are two more to help you on your way. Mr. Sawman, some handle you have there. It was the handle Sawman got my attention. I have used a machete on a few heads that come right off. Vietnam will do that to you. Mr. Fay, I hear about your letters being sold all the time. The people who do that, I generally leave alone. I dislike writing to someone and have them sell a letter because I have said things that are not cool for the eyes of others. Wish I was in Boston again. Last time I was there, I was a teenager. So was this kind of a thinly veiled threat to you? You know, you just got done telling us how he was not happy that other people were selling it. Now he's saying, hey, I hear that you're selling letters. And people that do that, I don't like to be their friend. And I feel that you shouldn't be letting other people see what I have to write. Do you think that was a thinly veiled threat towards you?
Yeah, I was taken a little off balance, but that's why I figured I had to cool things off with the initial letter that I wrote back to him. So I was very delicate in how I wrote back, and so things were cooled out. But yeah, I was not all that comfortable with that first letter from him.
And then the end of the letter, it kind of feeds right into what you were saying. Melissa of California, I'd like to rattle her bones a few times for real. She would not be the same afterwards. Ha ha. Mr. Fay, you now have her photos. Do as you wish with them. Stay cool later, Arthur Shawcross.
Oh, yeah. So
would he give you more information than just Melissa of California? Was he giving you full names and addresses of these people?
Yeah, I got her full name. I still have it. I'll dig that out for you.
Right.
But I'll send that. But Melissa, I almost can see the name in my mind. It just does eluding me right now. Yeah.
Well, yeah, reach out to me afterwards and we'll do that because it'd be nice to see. And maybe we can help put you with the right person to see if they can get some closure for these other names that appeared on the list so that you can live up to that justice side of you. And perhaps that'll unleash more of the goodness. You know, I mean, if think of all the families that are still wondering what happened and who was behind
them. Course.
If you could give final resolution to them, that would be remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Good. Yes.
The Shawcross Letters is out and available. My Journey into the Mind of Evil, John Paul Fay. How did Shawcross's life end? What was the eventual?
It was an embolism in his leg that traveled up to his heart. That's what killed him, basically. Ultimately, I guess more or less a heart attack. But
all right, in ending that. That was the end of everything. And how long had you been estranged from him at that point?
Almost 3 years. It was like two and a half years. Yeah.
Right.
2.5 years. Yeah.
And in that time, did he ever reach back out to try to rekindle a friendship or try to get your attention again?
No. It kind of died out. But I tell you, I'm friends with his daughter now, Maggie. We met on the Dr. Phil show there. Now we're pretty close friends. Yeah. Maggie Shawcross.
Okay. You talked to Maggie. Does she ever have fears that, for herself that, this gene is a part of her that, maybe the evil lives on? Has that ever been part of a discussion you've had?
It doesn't seem to bother her. I think she has discussed that, but it's very far in the back of her mind, if at all. She's a very outspoken woman, very strong woman. So that doesn't seem to be a major thing in her head, But she still loved her father despite everything.
Were they surprised? I mean, was her mother, his wife, were they aware of the heinous activities he was doing?
I mean, while he was doing, obviously not while he was doing them, but she didn't even know he was her father until she was later in her life, and then she finally discovered that and started to visit him in prison and everything. But yeah, she had no idea for a long time that he was even her dad.
But his wife, did she ever get a sense that Arthur was doing these things?
Right. No, nobody apparently did. Nobody. He lived a very, secretive life. And that's the way it goes. That's how they're able to get away with it for so long. A lot of these serial killers, whatnot. Apparently nobody had an idea or any inkling whatsoever. Yeah.
That's unbelievable to be that prolific a killer that we've got a list here of 30 plus names and nobody sensed it. Do you believe her? Do you believe that she really had no sense that this was going on, or do you think she turned a blind eye? Because I can't believe that he was able to be a part of a relationship and doing murders, especially for at least 2 years.
Right. Well, yes.
You couldn't pick up on it.
I wonder. I don't know. I mean, again, it's a very good question. I really don't know. I mean, I don't want to make any assumptions, but yeah, how somebody could hide something like that so well, I don't know. Yeah, I'm very curious now too.
Yeah. All right. Well, John, thank you for your time today, for sharing the story, and stay on the path, man. Stay on the truth and justice path. And that doesn't mean go out looking to get yourself killed or to kill anybody else.
No.
You know, you can do other good things. You can be an advocate for these families that lost people and refocus your intention on that instead of taking to the streets looking to, you know, maim or hurt someone or yourself. Yeah. That would be a tragic ending to a life. Yeah.
I do agree with you. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. Have a great rest of your day and hopefully a very happy new year.
Oh, thank you. You too.
Thank you very much. All right, Tim, that I have to say is a first here on True Crime Tuesday, an interview that went a completely different direction than I ever suspected it would.
Boy, I'll say. Yeah.
Our guest supplied us with names, which, of course, I'll make sure that law enforcement, local law enforcement in those areas are aware of these names by pointing them to his book, which he wrote and details these names. I don't feel that's a betrayal in any way. As he said, he felt that, you know, he put all this out there.
Yeah,
it's available for the telling. Mm-hmm. And I promise my friends and listeners that whatever information he gives me regarding the people that Shawcross wanted dead, I will investigate the names and see if there is any follow up that took place in those cases, and not necessarily by John Paul Fay, but did they meet an untimely death during the lifespan of Arthur Shawcross? That's another very strange rabbit hole to follow. But I don't know. I don't know how I feel about this. I mean, it was, you know, obviously a different look into the mind of a killer, not only from a man who talked to a killer and befriended a killer, but from somebody whose mind is very, as he kind of mentioned, he was very fragile at a lot of these points and had considered these fantasies and predilections to dark activity.
Yeah, I'm almost speechless, to be honest with you. It was a very, very interesting look into what you could say is a double-edged sword. He really kind of straddles that line. And it's he has a very firm sense of justice, but in the same sense, I mean, it's a very edgy line at that. I mean, you know, it's a thin line between justice and vigilantism, you know.
Fascinating. Either way, let's turn our senses around for the holidays, Tim. Let's lighten things up a little bit with a little dumb crimes and stupid crime.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude Christbearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Tim, here are some very strange stories to wrap up our year with. We're going to start off from the Idaho Statesman newspaper.
All right.
A Montana man told police a hunter mistook him for Bigfoot and shot at him.
Ooh.
A Montana man was out target shooting when he became a target himself, and it was because a man mistook him for Bigfoot, he told authorities. The 27-year-old from Helena told dispatchers on Monday that a day earlier he had been putting up targets on public lands outside the city when bullets started flying towards him. Lewis and Clark County Sheriff Leo Dutton said in a phone interview with McClatchy, the man said one bullet hit 3 feet to his left on Sunday and another whizzed past him on the right. He explained that he ran into the trees for cover as more gunfire came his way. Eventually, he came out to confront the man in a black Ford F-150 who shot at him. He said, "I thought you were Bigfoot," the shooter told the victim in the victim's telling of the story, according to Dutton. "I don't target practice, but if I see something that looks like Bigfoot, I just shoot at it."
No.
The man said he responded that he's not Bigfoot. The shooter advised the man to wear orange in the future, and the man said he told the shooter that was a good point, according to Dutton. Law enforcement... Boy, so it's dumb crimes and almost as stupid a victim. Local law enforcement are now looking for leads on who the person in the black F-150 might be. Though Dutton said there was some question about the veracity of the report because it was called in the day after the alleged near-death incident and because the man couldn't describe the alleged shooter. The man also said he didn't want to pursue charges and didn't want to talk to deputies, Dutton said. Police checked the area where the reported shooting took place but didn't find the pickup. After reports of alleged shooting appeared in the Helena Independent Record, another woman came forward with a similar experience, potentially bolstering the man's story, Dutton said. The woman told law enforcement that she had been shot at by a man in a black F-150 as well. Bigfoot didn't come up in that woman's report, according to Dutton, but the woman did give a better description of the man, who she said she also confronted about shooting at her. "We're working to find this person," Dutton said. "It's a great concern." No shit, Sherlock. "It's a great concern. This individual might think he's shooting at anything and calls it Bigfoot. If the charges are true, the shooter could face attempted negligent homicide charges." However, Dutton said he doesn't think the public is in danger. "It seemed to be a localized event in one geographic area," Dutton said, referring to the North Hills area near Helena. A study in 2017 found that despite sightings reported across the country each year, only 16% of Americans believe Bigfoot is real, McClatchy reported. Compare that with 50% of people who believe in ghosts and 35% who believe in ancient aliens visiting our planet. Nice weird deflection at the end. Maybe my true crime bug is humming after our last conversation, but I might look to see if there are any current hunters missing.
You
might want to go seek bring out some blood cadaver dogs out to those woods to see if our old intrepid Bigfoot hunter may have whacked a couple of people by accident already. Holy Christmas.
It may not necessarily be an accident either. It's a kind of a convenient excuse to go out and start shooting people and saying that you're out looking for Bigfoot. Yeah.
Greenfield is the next story. Christopher Simpson of Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, pled not guilty to charge of misdemeanor theft in connection with an incident at Walmart near 108th and Layton in Greenfield on December 5th. According to the criminal complaint, an officer responded to the Walmart and found an individual holding down Simpson. Simpson, age 39, told officers he tried to leave the store with 10 to 15 video games, but was body slammed by a random guy.
Attaboy.
That good Samaritan held Simpson down until police arrived on the scene. The incident was all captured on camera. The loss prevention officer on the scene told Simpson covered the video games with his clothing and then attempted to leave, but was detained by the good Samaritan. Will that be his wrestling name? Ladies and gentlemen,
could be, yeah.
Straight from Walmart, the good Samaritan.
I wonder what that slam would be called then. Probably the slam of... No, I don't know. I got nothing.
Yeah,
I'm wondering where our buddy, the Beer City Bruiser, was at that point, because I'm willing to bet that's something he would do. I think he probably, in the name of justice, would probably, and probably a reward of one of those video games, would probably help out that Walmart.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was a slam then. It was probably the cuddle of justice that he laid upon him. How
probably,
about that?
Yeah, the cuddle of justice.
The cuddle of justice.
Yeah,
the total value of video games is estimated to be approximately $275. Simpson entered his not guilty plea in court on Monday. He's due back in court on December 26th.
Only $275?
Yeah, that's it. Video games aren't real expensive.
Was he raiding the bargain bin?
I don't know. We're going to Altoona, Pennsylvania. Altoona police said retired Marine Corps combat veteran disarmed a man trying to rob a bar early Tuesday morning. Vigilante week here, apparently. According to police, a black man walked into AJ's bar on Maple Avenue sometime around 1 a.m. and attempted to rob the bar. Police said the retired Marine, who was bartending, was able to disarm the robber while he was handing over money from the cash register. Police said the two got into a struggle and one round was fired from the gun. Neither of them were hit by the bullet, but police said they believe the suspect has obvious facial injuries from being hit with the gun. Police said the bartender wasn't hurt. According to police, the would-be robber got away and fled on foot northbound across Maple Avenue. A blood trail led police to the backyard of a home on not far away from the bar. The gun was recovered at the scene, according to police. The gun used in the attempted robbery was reported stolen several months ago. Police said the man was last seen wearing a blue winter jacket, blue winter hat, jeans, and a gray-red plaid scarf that covered most of his face. Police said he is 5'7" tall and about 180 pounds with an afro-style haircut.
Attaboy.
They ask that anyone with information on this incident, please call the 911 immediately, Tim.
Can I tell you, Dave, I would, if God had left me with the privilege of hair, I would have a full afro right now.
Would you?
I would. I
Big
love.
Picked up afro?
When I was younger, I had a dry Jerry curl.
Wow.
I did.
And then you went on to look like Richard Marx.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
totally abused the privilege of hair. But I would.
That's why God took it away from you.
Yeah, that's why he took it away from me. But if I had hair right now, I'd have a full blown out white man's afro right now. I would.
Thank you, Lord. Thank you for the gift of baldness for Tim. That's all I've got to say. We're going to Hialeah, Florida, where it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. A Florida man is accused of stealing a Christmas wreath off the front door of a home and then hanging it outside his own home. News outlets report that 55-year-old Angel Hugo Souls Roma Guerra is facing burglary and petty theft charges in the December 7th incident that was captured on a Ring front door camera. Hialeah Police Lieutenant Eddie Rodriguez tells WPLG The Plug that Roma Guerra turned himself in Tuesday night after learning that police were searching for him. Investigators had spotted the wreath hanging outside his home, which is about 4 miles from the victim's house. Roma Guerra was held. Oh, God, are you kidding me? Okay, Tim.
Yeah?
You go, you take a wreath. It's almost Christmas time. You take a wreath off somebody's front door, take it to your home, and hang it on your front door. Okay. What is your bond? Tell me the bond. What would be a good bond for that, Tim?
$500.
$10,500 bond.
What? No
way. Was this made of solid gold and the tears of an angel?
It had to be for that much.
Good God. We're going to Belgium, Tim. We're Belgian buffoons.
Love me some chocolate.
Have been foiled.
They're either
the world's most accommodating criminals, the greediest, or the most optimistic, or possibly, as we like to call them, the dumbest criminals. The BBC reports that on the 15 tense minutes Saturday for a Belgian e-cigarette shop owner identified simply as Didier.
Hello, I'm Didier. This is my smoke shop.
When a half dozen wannabe armed robbers showed up mid-afternoon at his store outside, I told them clearly that 3 p.m. is not the best time to hold up a store, Didier tells RTL via CNN. The can. Instead, he managed to stammer out if they come back later on, he'd possibly have more euros to hand over.
I'm sorry, right now it's not a good time for this robbery. Could you please come back later when there's more euros to give to you?
To his surprise, they agreed that was a better idea, and they left. The cops didn't buy Didier's story that the suspects would actually return, but they did. Not once, but twice. First, the suspect showed up around 5:30 p.m., and Didier shook his head at their too early return.
I berated them, saying, you'll have to buy a watch.
He says, noting he told them to come back at 6:30,
when the store would be closing for the evening.
The hopefuls were back at Didier's door an hour later. Plainclothes cops were there to nab them. It's like, it's a comedy, the incredulous shop owner tells the BBC.
They're being called the worst robbers in Belgium. Ha ha ha.
Five of the hopeful criminals were arrested, including a minor. The sixth managed to get away.
They weren't the brightest, Didier tells RTL.
It's funny that everyone in Belgium sounds like a movie Nazi.
Or Dieter from, that's what I was going for, Dieter from, the dance
Sprockets.
Party. Here's, this would be me. I got to be honest with you. If I ever decided I'm robbing this bank, Tim, this is probably how it would play out for me. A would-be bank robber turned into a would-be bank customer Friday afternoon. The suspect walked into the Bayonne, New Jersey bank and handed a teller a note demanding all the money. But as the teller read the note, he snatched it back from her and said, hey, you know what, can I just open an account?
That's what
NJ.com reports. A customer service rep met with him in another area, but the suspect didn't have the ID needed to open an account as the man was meeting with yet another employee. The teller told the customer service rep about the note. The employee confronted the suspect and escorted him out of the building. By the time police and bank security were alerted to the incident, he was gone. An ongoing investigation continues, Tim.
Hmm.
Might you have alerted as soon as he said, nah, you know what, I'm just going to open an account. Might you have hit the old buzzer at that point?
Yeah, yeah. I think at that point you're busted. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Stone cold busted. I just, you know. You know what? Give me the note back. No, let's just, I want to open an account, actually. I've got all this money I stole from the Citgo down the street. Let me deposit that. And if I'm going to make this my bank, I want it to be a safer bank, so I don't want it so easily robbed. So let's, you know, that would be my whole thing. Our final story, Tim, takes us to Mesa, Arizona.
Oh.
Where police in Mesa say a man is in custody after allegedly killing his roommate over their choice of music, Tim.
Oh, no.
Almost understandable. They say 41-year-old Sheldon Sturgill is jailed on suspicion of second-degree murder. It was unclear Monday if Sturgill even has a lawyer. Police say officers were sent to an apartment complex last Friday about a reported shooting and found Sturgill at the scene. Sturgill reportedly told officers he shot his roommate after an argument and fist fight over the type of music they were listening to at the time. What music would raise your ire to that point that you're willing to shoot a roommate? You know my answer, Fleetwood Mac and Steely Dan, Tim.
Wow.
In my opinion, if you've left a loaded gun and you play either one of those bands in front of me, you're taking a good chance of me kicking your stuffed animals or shooting you. What music would set you off, Tim?
I would say pan flute music. Might be a good
Jethro Tull should duck, is what they're saying. Duck and cover.
I would think so. I would think a marathon of
We shouldn't joke about this because of, you know, the horrific shooting that took place in Vegas last year. Yeah. There's nothing that would ever bring us to that point. But my God, a fight over what music you listen to leads to a shooting.
Yeah, serious.
No surprise here. Sturgill told police he had been drinking shots and beers with his roommate before the fight and shooting occurred. It's always the liquor and the devil's lettuce involved, Tim. It's always one or both of those stories.
Actually, I found out that it's not necessarily the devil's lettuce. No, that you're pretty mellow on that. I think it's just the liquor. I think when you're drinking liquor, especially the heavier stuff, I think you tend to get a little more irritated.
Huh.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it this week, folks. We hope that you and yours have a very, very Merry Christmas and a happy holiday season, no matter what your belief systems are. And we also wish you from the bottom of our hearts a very, very happy new year. For Tim Demas, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the best in True Crime Talk Radio. This is True Crime Tuesday.